First of all, take me back to how it all began, the formation of the band.
Okay, this is Rob. I'll take that. Greg and I were in like a advanced English class in around 7th grade, and we'd meet before class, like, it was kind of an outdoor building. We'd always meet before class, and we'd talk about music and bars and stuff like that, and, you know, we talked about starting a band because he was starting to play guitar, and I always wanted to play drums, so we said, hey, let's get together and start a band, and we knew this guy, Jerry Fogle, who was a friend of ours, and he was already playing guitar, and so we said, okay, well, let's get together as a band with him, and at the time in that English class, the required book was The Lord of the Rings by J.R. Tolkien, and so that kind of what gave us our first taste of fantasy literature, and that's kind of where we kind of decided on to where I get our name from. You know, actually, we first started off as a band called Titanic. We had another guy in a band, Pat Galligan, who went on to be in a band, the Angry Samoans, kind of a punk band. But I can skip over this kind of briefly because a lot of the stuff we did back then, we were playing a lot of Beatles covers and stuff like that, but Greg, me, and Jerry really wanted to go in a heavier direction, and Greg would always turn me on to albums, and I remember I'd go over to his house, and he gave me Mountain Climbing when it first came out, and he goes, man, you got to listen to this record, you know, and I took it home, and I played it, and I'm like, wow, this is really great. So the whole time we're in this band Titanic, we're playing, like, covers and doing some school dances and stuff like that. Jerry and Greg wanted to kind of split away, and so at one point we told Pat, we said, hey, you know, this isn't working out, so I think we're going to split away and start our own band, and that's kind of how Skrathungo got formed.
What did the band get up to in the 70s then?
What do you mean, get up to?
Well, obviously, the band formed in 72, and the first album came out in 1980, so I was wondering, what band was up to in those 8 years?
Okay, yeah, well, that's a long story. Well, when we started, we were in seventh grade, so you figure we got around 5 more years of school, so we were going to school, and we were playing places, and this is where I got to kick in. I'm going to put in a shout-out to my parents, because my mom's really sick and not doing so well right now, and my dad passed away around 10 years ago, but we bounced around from parents to parents' houses because no one would let us play there, and we finally ended up at my parents' house, and they let us practice in my old sister's bedroom for like maybe, I would say, seven years at least, or from the time pretty much when the band started till we came out with our first album. And so, you know, if it kind of wasn't for my parents, I'm not sure whether we would have had a band, because we started off playing at Jerry's house, and his mom yelled at us that it was too loud. And then we started playing at Greg's house. Greg's mom came in one day screaming at us, going, turn that off, you guys have to leave. So, because, you know, we were playing, every year we'd get bigger amplifiers, and we start playing louder and louder, so we finally ended up at my parents' house. And because the neighbors next door were related to us, they couldn't say anything. So we put a big board in the window, and we actually had a really cool kind of band room there, and that's where a lot of the early songs on Servants of Chaos, that just got re-released. Laugh, High Performance, some of Tim's unbelievable singing on there too. That all was recorded in that bedroom at my parents' house. And so we're going to school, we're writing new songs, we're trying to do stuff. The reason it was so long in between getting a record out is we were sending in demo tapes to record companies. No one ever would respond. We're trying to set up jobs in L.A. It was really hard to set up jobs unless you're on a record label or you're touring. It was really hard to play some of the big clubs. But we would always play all these kind of like Battle of the Bands and all sorts of, you know, any concerts that we could set up, we try to set up and play. What really started off, and this is where we kind of hit the radar with our first album, we played a Battle of the Bands, and I think we came in maybe third place. So they gave us like a $500 gift certificate to a local recording studio, and we'd never actually been in a real studio before, so we're like, wow, this is really cool. We had a friend, Randy Jackson, who'd been injured in an oil field accident. He like almost broke his back, and he got a little bit of money, and so he said that he'd actually pay for the production of our first album, So he loaned us some money. You know, we paid him back, of course. He loaned us some money to actually, like, finish the recording and actually produce the first album, which we produced completely on our own and paid for it. So all that time went by. It seems like we weren't doing anything, but, you know, back then, unless you're on a record label, nothing happened. And when we first put out our first record, there wasn't really anyone in Los Angeles, at least, that was doing that. Now, right after we put out our record, Motley Crue, you know, Brian at Metal Blade, all these guys started putting out their compilations and stuff. But to my knowledge, and I'm not saying no one before did it, but when this new wave of independent heavy rock was coming out, we were the first band in Los Angeles to actually record, produce, and release our first album.
When did you come on board then, Tim? Because you weren't originally part of the band, I believe?
No, originally I met him in high school, and I met Greg I think first, and I saw him. He had they don't have patches and crap on their jackets and stuff, like Blue Oyster Cult and stuff, things that I knew. So I struck up a conversation with him and said, "Yo, I'm in a band, metal band and stuff, and you should come up and check us out." So I said, "Yeah, that's cool." So the first time I go up to Rob's house, you know, I see him hanging out the window, there's no screen on the window, he's got his head hanging out. "Hey, it's up here." So I go up there, and like Rob said, they practice in a bedroom, full drum set, giant stacks. Greg, Jerry, and Rob playing in a bedroom full blast, and I just got blown away the first time I went up there. It was just mind-blowingly loud and great. So after that, you know, I just started hanging out all the time. And then me and Rob became really good friends and started, and it ended up, you know, Greg ended up getting some stuff, recording equipment there to, you know, do demos and stuff. And Rob and I started playing around with it, and then we do after practice and stuff, we go in there and do vocals and just mess around, everything like that. And then we kind of got serious doing it, and it just kind of evolved into that. And, you know, the whole time they were kind of looking for a singer, and then they didn't have one. They tried a couple of people, this and that, and then I said, things were kind of going okay, so I guess they decided to go with me, lucky for me, and that's just how I kind of got in there. At first I was, doing sound for the band. It would be, Rob said, they'd go out and play battles of bands and stuff like that, and it'd be a three-piece, a lot of the times it would just be instrumental stuff, and I would run all the lines and amps and do the mixing and all that kind of stuff. So it just kind of evolved over time, and I'm glad that it did.
Yeah, getting back, not to plug this re-release, a lot of people ask us, why this came out. Around 2000 or so, we were talking about, actually Metal Blade Records was contacting me and saying, in Germany especially, and they're going, "Hey, you guys have any other stuff? You know, all your records are out. You guys want to reform or anything?" I'm going, we weren't really thinking about getting back together. But they're saying, "Well, do you have any other tapes or any old stuff or anything?" And me and Greg kind of looked at all our stuff, and we had a bunch of the original recordings. And my theory was, if we didn't put this out then, this stuff was going to get lost to history, because a lot of the tapes were starting to deteriorate, especially the real good studio Ampex tapes, the really expensive, real good tapes actually were starting to fall apart. And they actually had to be sent out to a lady who baked them in an oven like a cake, which baked the magnetic kind of powder onto the tapes. They ran them through the machine and put them onto a digital audio a cassette. And if they hadn't have done that, those tapes would have been lost forever. So all that original stuff, like I said, what Tim was talking about, we were experimenting around and singing. Like I said, the songs High Performance, Last Laugh, those songs on Servants of Chaos, all those songs were ones that we did. Actually, our recording studio was a closet in the bedroom.
Yeah, with a four-track machine, a little quarter-inch tape player.
Yeah, exactly.
Four tracks, and me and Rob would just go in there for hours and just do crazy vocal stuff. It was pretty awesome, really.
Actually, I thought I sang some really good songs too, but
we don't have those.
They never made it. Tim. Getting back to Tim, we actually had another singer for a while when the band first started, Neil, and he was a great guy. He was a good showman. Matter of fact, we played a couple of places. And, he threatened, this was kind of like when Iggy and the Stooges was coming out, he threatened to take his clothes off and stuff, and we actually were on the front page of the newspaper. It says, "Stuart Fungal's singer threats to disrobe in front of audience or something. So, and he was in the band for a while, and it's really kind of sad, because he was like, he was kind of a, I don't want to say he was a bad singer, because he wasn't, but he was a more like, if you think Iggy's a good singer, Neil was a good singer. But, I mean, we were looking for something, we took ourselves very, very seriously, and a lot of people ask me this, you know, the Motley Crues and the Rats and all those hair bands, and they were coming out, you know, after we put out our first record, you know, to us, they were like a joke. You know, it's like, we thought of ourselves as like Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, you know, all these bands, you know, Cactus, Fudgie, Captain Beyond, you know, these are the bands that we were listening to, like all the really serious rock bands who were trying to stand on their music, and the music was really important. Getting back to another story, we have thousands of funny little stories. We actually, and this is how our album got started. We knew Brian Slagle worked at a place, Oz Records, down in near Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley. And he said, he goes, I want to put out my own record and start my own record company. We're all, yeah, that's really cool. And he goes, well, do you guys want to be on it? And we said, yeah. And we had a song, Death of the Sun, which we were kind of one of our demo songs. At the same time, we were finishing up the production of our first album, Frost and Fire. He goes, I know these guys that could actually, they're importers and exporters, and maybe they're interested in selling your record overseas. And so we met up with these guys. The company was called Green World. And what we originally did is we'd sell them like 500 or 1,000 records, and then they'd sell them, and they were actually importing records into Europe. So they weren't a big record company. They were a distribution company. And after around a week, they called back and said, hey, can we have another 1,000 or 5,000 or whatever? So we sold quite a few records from them. And then they finally came over one night. The guy, and I have a recording somewhere because it's probably a bunch of bullshit and lies, but the guy came over one night and told us how, oh, we're going to, we really want to support the band and take you guys on to the next level and this and that. So we sold the rights off originally to this company, Green World. Now, at the same time, Brian was coming out with his first Metal Blade record ever, Metal Massacre 1, which we were on. And we always kind of reflect back there, like, what if we hadn't gone with these Greenwell guys and maybe stuck with Brian? You know, maybe we actually, we'd be big and famous like Brian is now.
How did the band get Michael Whelan to do art with then? Was he fairly... Was he famous at the time then, or just not that famous? Or
about Michael?
Yeah, the guy who did the cover art was well, oh, Mike, very well known.
Hey, this is another kind of a neat story. We wanted to put out a record, you know, we had already finished recording. We wanted to, the cover that I wanted actually was, I liked fantasy literature. We're reading a lot of Conan the Barbarian, Elric, by Michael Moorcock, famous English author. So we're reading all this sword and sorcery fantasy stuff. And once again, Greg was the guy, you know, Greg go, hey, read this book. And he'd hand me Stormbringer or something like that. And I'd read it. I'm like, wow, this is unbelievable. So I was reading all the Conan books, and one of the Conan books had a cover of a painting by Frank Frazetta called Berserker. And it shows a guy on his horse, and he's jumping over all these, like, dead bodies. And he's got a sword over his head, and he's like a half, like, a goblin monster guy, you know. And we go, wow, this is really cool. And almost at that very exact same time, a band in the United States, some southern rock band, Molly Hatchet, came out with this cover. And we're like, oh, damn, that's what we wanted, you know. And we never contacted the guy, so we never really knew how to get a hold of it, but we're saying, this is if we could use this, this is what we would use. And to tie this back to some of our influences, the band Dust, that was from New York, they had one of Frank Frazetta's pictures of three, like, giant, kind of like dwarf trolls or something fighting on top of a mountain in the snow. That was on their second album, Heart Attack. So that was from the same painter, and we're going, yeah, this would be kind of cool. Anyway, after Molly Hatchet came out with that album, we're going, hey, what are we going to put on here? Well, I was reading Stormbringer, and I'm looking at this going, man, this is the greatest. This is better than anything that we could ever use. So I wrote to a publishing company, and they put us in touch with Michael Whelan, and, he said, sure. He goes, yeah.
Nobody ever asked him to do an album cover before at that time, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Because his stuff is so great.
He was mainly doing a book cover. Horror books like H.P. Lovecraft and
Stephen King.
A lot of the Moorcock stuff. He did feel bad for Michael because, once again, our hope was for us to become really big and famous, you know, and all these people that had kind of supported us and stood by us. My dream was someday, you know, he had the actual painting Stormbringer. I go, I want to buy that. And I go, he goes, well, look, I'm going to hang on to it because it's my favorite painting. And I go, well, someday when I'm rich, you know, I'm going to pay you, you know, whatever that's worth. So don't worry, okay. But we never made it big. And I just feel like, you know, because him allowing us to use his paintings on our records, I think really helped the band. And I believe that actually, you know, they fit our music. It's not like he was giving us like any kind of charity thing. It's just that I don't think we ever compensated him fairly for the use of the paintings that he allowed us to use.
And is it right that Greg actually did the bass on the album? Or not?
No.
That's wrong, is it?
Well, on Fast and Far, yes, Greg played bass.
Yeah, that's what I was asking, yeah. Why wasn't he credited on the album as playing bass then?
I'll let Tim handle this.
It was kind of a weird situation because Greg played, we'd already laid down the tracks, I think, if I remember right, and at the same time we were kind of recruiting Flint from another band. We'd known him for a while, and we'd seen, you know, we played gigs, you know, together as a band that he used to be in. And, you know, we always liked his bass player, and we'd say, hey, someday we're going to steal you away, you know, for a bass player, because Greg more really wanted to play guitar, you know, so, you know, I guess nobody really wants to play bass or whatever. But, so, you know, we kind of thought about, yeah, we'd get a bass player that we could have two guitar players, Greg and Jerry. And at the time, Flint didn't really know the songs that well and stuff, and Greg, like I said, he basically all his songs, so he knew all the, you know, he wrote them and played on them, so that's how that kind of evolved. But as a, you know, as something for Flint, I mean, like, he'd been playing on the songs for a while before the record came out, so, I mean, it was really no, I mean, he played just as well as Greg, if not better, so, I mean, there was no harm in putting his name on there, I thought, and nobody else had any issues with it either, so, I mean, it could have been him or Greg, either one. That played it, so it would have came out, you know, just as good. So that's how that kind of came about. So
I want to add something here too. You know, Greg was always a good guy, and even though he left the band, and I feel badly about every guy that left the band. I have like all sorts of regrets and ill feelings over. But Greg was cool, and like, you know, he played on the album. But he's all, you know, Flint's our bass player now, so he goes, you know, we'll put, you know,
yeah, put him on it. No harm, no foul, kind of.
And for anyone, you know, and Greg did some pretty radical bass things on Better Off Dead and stuff. There's some cool stuff on there. But anyone that doubts Flint's playing ability, if you listen to the bass on, like, the intro to Master of the Pit, you know, on King of the Dead, you know, you'll hear, you know, a lot of his good bass playing.
Rob, you mentioned, like, Neil earlier. Is there any stuff recorded with Neil Lenn, previous singer?
Neil? No, there is a few songs. And I, you know, I have a box of some old cassettes, and that's another story where the DVD came with on here. We had a couple of videos of us, and you got to remember, this is for MTV or any of that crap. The video that's in Service of Chaos, here's what happened. We're playing this club, and, you know, the guy had a video camera, like, on a tripod, like, up on the balcony, and the thing was, like, you know, he goes, if you pay me $20, I'll record your show, right? So... So we give him a tape, we go buy him a VHS tape, you know, he give him $20, you know, the camera had like a little microphone on it. And of course, like Tim mentioned, we were like a pretty loud band, you know, we always played really loud. And so that's why the actual video looked halfway decent, but the sound of it was just destroyed. I was looking through one of these boxes, and I think Tim was over here that day. Yeah. I'm actually looking through a box. And I go, my God, I go, look, I think this is the actual mixing console tape off of that really bad video that we have, right? And so we played it, and it turned out to be it was. And so Brian was saying, you know, hey, we want to re-release Servants of Chaos, but we want to put some other material in there. And
hey, we got a DVD.
Yeah, we got this video, and I said, now we have this tape. And Brian actually has a couple other tapes, and they may come out. He talks about re-release and maybe Frost and Fire and King of the Dead with, we have basically two other videos. Neither one of them, I'm not sure, is as good as the one that's on here, but both of them are kind of, I think, unusual because of, on the first one, Greg and Jerry are playing together, and on the other one's us playing at the Roxy, and it's actually kind of a really cool, was a cool show. So we're hoping maybe if they re-release Boston Fire and King of the Dead, they might put a bonus DVD in there with that, so.
How would you describe that first album then, like, musically speaking, compared to the rest of the catalogue?
First album?
Yeah, the first one, yeah.
Yeah, this is, you know, and I'm not trying to speed Tim out here by answering all, a lot of these questions, but
it's all right.
We decided, okay, here's what our plan was. Okay, we got this $500 from this Battle of the Band. Actually, came in third. There's a funny story to that. The band that won, their amps blew up or something, so we loaned them an amp. A lot of times our roadies, cause even though this is kind of primitive back in the 70s, you know, it's like all the other bands in town, they were kind of, you know, most of them were pretty crappy, and we actually had a couple of people that were good roadies, you know, and you know, even Tim was a roadie for a while at once.
And at that time, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we played somewhere, and I think we would have came in first place, but we loaned, we loaned one of our amps to this other band, and basically the Battle of the Bands back then, they wanted bands to play dances so that, you know, guys and girls would get together, like, so this is kind of like a beach town, so they'd have a, like, they wouldn't have a concert, they'd have a dance. And so
yeah, dance, so they could make some money.
Yeah, so they could, some guy could, you know, make some money off all the young kids in town, you know, like, it goes, and it's not like a prom, it's more like a dance, you know, where everyone goes, they'd show up drunk or get stoned or whatever and go dance together, right? And obviously our music wasn't dance music, you know, and this is where I'll throw in a thing that Tim always cracks up. We were playing one of these Battle of the Bands or something, and actually I think some people were dancing to our music. I used to sing background vocals, and sometimes I'd, you know, yell out something every once I had a microphone, and so I remember yelling out at these guys in the crowd going, I go, all you dancing fools, sit down, or something like that. And Tim, a lot of guys got, I've been getting laughs at that over the years, but someone asked me recently in an interview, how did you want your audiences to react? And I kind of expected, because of the big concerts I went to, I saw like Captain Beyond and Black Sabbath at the Hollywood Bowl, you know, and there was some Lake and Palmer, 4-channel sound at Long Beach Arena, and so I saw a lot of these big concerts, you know, and the actual audiences were pretty much awestruck, you know, I mean, people weren't dancing, there was no headbang, actually people, I think back then a lot of people were smoking pots, so a lot of people were kind of stoned, but they were, you know, they were sitting in their seats almost like they were mesmerized by the music, you know, almost like as if you went to a symphony concert, and so the fact that, you know, people were dancing to our music, I took it almost
disconcerting.
Yeah, it was like, it was insulting to me. It's like, you know, you wouldn't dance at a Beethoven symphony.
What was the original question? Sorry.
I'm sorry, I went off. The first album. But anyway, so we had this $500. We borrowed money from our friend. We're thinking, okay, if we're going to make it big, we're going to have to, like, get some airplay and get signed to a big label. Because we know, even on this independent label we're on, they're never going to give us their support. There's no money involved. They're just going to release our record, right, or sell it to Europe. So the plan was to make a record that was kind of like accessible. And out here at the time, if you didn't get airplay,
you were nothing.
You couldn't get signed. You couldn't get anything. And there were some heavy rock stations. You know, they played, you know, Black Sabbath, at least Paranoid, or some of the top, you know, the top hits of some of the heavy bands, right? So we put out Frost and Fire using almost all of Greg's songs, because Greg, even though we had a bunch of other songs, some that showed up on King of the Dead, but we had all these songs, but a lot of the songs Greg wrote kind of seemed to be more commercially viable, because they were, you know, they're singing about some of the songs like Better Off Dead, or Maybe That's Why, or some of that stuff. So they had lyrics that were kind of, we thought were commercially accessible, right? So we put out this record, the one station in L.A., KRLA, that played a lot of rock stuff, played it a couple of times, and then they said, you know, this is way too heavy stuff. We can't play this. And about at the time, Greg was leaving the band because he was kind of decided he wanted to go in a different direction, and we wanted to go even heavier, right? So we're going, well, shit, if that was our commercial stuff and it was too heavy, we decided, you know, that's bullshit. You know, we're going to come out, our next album, we're going to do it the way we want to do it.
Yeah, which is, like, really heavy, and, yeah. But actually, to go on with that, like Rob was saying, that Frost of Fire was never intended to be an album that was out for sale to the public. It was our attempt to get a record deal with a big company. That's why it was more like a demo for us instead of, at the time, all you companies, they'd throw them in the trash. You know, send out another cassette to another record company or management, and they'd throw it in the trash. So we thought that if we put out a real album, but, you know, the whole professional-looking thing, and shop that around, well, it would show these guys, like, you know, well, here's guys that are on the ball, and this is what we can actually do. It was never meant to be a general release to the public. It was more of a demo to get a record deal. And like Rob said before, it just kind of evolved into getting released to the public, and it just kind of steamrolled from there into the, you know, the next couple of records.
Now, also, too, it's like, and Tim was mentioning this, and I totally agree, you know, we thought, you know, this was going to get our foot in the door, because you asked what we did for at least 10 years before we put out our first record. We were driving down to L.A., we were sitting in front of, like, record companies, you know, one of us would run in saying, you know, okay, we're going to run through security or something and, you know, try to get our cassette on the desk. There was this guy, Ted Templeman, that did Montrose's first album. He was a good producer, you know, I kept sending him copies of tapes, and we even had, when Neil was our singer, there was this one guy that worked for Apple Records, and we kept going down to all these concerts and trying to get backstage to talk to the managers, and we'd met Rush. Rush was actually playing at the Whiskey Go-Go. We were trying to get a job down playing at the Whiskey Go-Go, and one of our friends said, he goes, hey, there's this band from Canada, Rush, it's really good. So we go, hey, well, let's go down and see them, and we'll talk to the booking agent. Well, when we showed up that night, we were the only ones there to see Rush. So if you can believe this, there was like, Rush was playing at the Whiskey Go-Go, there was like four people in the crowd, and it was all the members of Sirathungal. So we actually went backstage, met the guys in Rush, and hung out with them, and kind of made a little bit of friends with them. But we're asking them too, you know, how do you, you know, how do we break into the big time? And they go, well, there's this big music convention in L.A. Maybe you should go down there and smooch around the guys and hang out. So we'd go to all these weird functions. You know, we always had all these, you know, cassette tapes of the band, and it just, they were getting us, like, nowhere.
Well, that's why that's really why Frosted Fire came about, so.
And right about that time, though, you know, like I said, we were about the first band, if not the first band ever to do that. After we released our first album, maybe it was all kind of happening all together, or maybe people saw what we did, but within a matter of 6 months of us releasing our first album, Motley Crue had an album out, Brian had his first album out, you know, all these guys, because they saw, hey, the big record companies don't have a stranglehold anymore on at least distribution of these albums. Maybe they still can't stop them from getting played on the air, but if you make your own record, you could get it out there. Right now, if similar things happening on the internet, you don't even need to make a record anymore. All you have to do is have a website and have music, and people can download it. So.
Do you think the band would have been more successful if there was, like, the internet and iTunes back 30 years ago?
Oh, probably no doubt about that. I mean, it's you know, but I mean, like now, I mean, bands just pop up out of nowhere, and I mean, it's like Rob was saying, I mean, it's so much easier to promote yourself now with the, you know, the internet and all that kind of stuff. It would have been a big help. I mean, just to get your name out there and all, I mean, all it takes is a couple of things to go viral, as they say. And I mean, you could be like, you know, look at somebody, somewhere like, whatever, like, what's that kid's name, that Justin Bieber guy or whatever?
Oh,
I mean,
fucking
like, kids and stuff, and all of a sudden they're like famous 2 years later and they're playing arenas. I mean, it just goes to prove, I mean, nowadays it can happen to anybody, whether you got talent or not. It just, people latch on to. So I mean, it would have been a lot, you know, it would have been a lot easier to maybe get the things done nowadays if we would have been, you know, starting out now. But, you know, who's to say? I mean, you never know what's going to happen, so.
I don't want to disagree with Tim, but I think nowadays, though, there's so many bands.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a bazillion.
A
matter of fact, I go on Facebook or MySpace, and the guy's in a band, and I said, you know, they go, hey, we worshiped you, and I go, well, send me your CD, because I don't got any money to buy CDs, right? So a lot of guys send me CDs, and the bands are actually pretty good, so I think there's a lot of bands out there. But the missing link to all this was, what made the bands really big originally were the record companies paying for tour support and all that stuff, and that's disappeared.
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
But
so.
This is where I have to give a shout-out to Brian Slagle at Metal Blade Records, because I got to tell you this, if it weren't for Brian, Brian's taking the place of the big record companies, because Metal Blade Records, not only did they release a lot of our records, they have bands out there now like Powerwolf and Brainstorm and, you know, Autumn, all these heavy, heavy, heavy rock bands. And if it wasn't for him doing that, you know, I'm not sure that those bands would even have a place or...
They'd be on MySpace or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, Brian, I got to tell you this, Brian was one of our first friends. He gave give us one of our first breaks. The fact that all of our records except for Paradise Lost are back on Metal Blade. And all I can say is, like, not only is a visionary guy, but he's like a really good guy, and I think he's really, his heart is with the music. And I think that's why, you know, even though he's become very big and successful, I think that he still loves the music, and I, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking right
now. Oh, yeah, like, I still see him. We go down to LA to go see shows. I mean, I went to Megadeth, like, last year or whatever. I ran into Brian, you know, in the lobby. Hey, Brian, what are you doing? Hey, how you doing? You know, I was like, so he's still out there, like, you know, promoting, besides his own record label. I mean, he's still out there as a fan, you know, going to see bands and stuff that he likes. So, you know, like Rob said, he's you know, he's been there for us and, like, a lot of other bands over the years, and it's a good thing, because otherwise, a lot of good stuff that nobody would have ever heard.
Why did Greg leave the band in 82, then?
When?
Why?
Well, the story is that he decided that he was, you know, and he was, Greg was a real smart guy, like a really, he wanted to be an engineer, and that's what he is today. He's an engineer, and he wanted to, he was actually going off to college, and, you know, 4-year college and stuff like that, and like I said, we kind of were going a different way. We wanted to play a little bit more heavier stuff and stuff like that, so, you know, it was kind of a good time for it to happen. He went away to college, and, you know, we just kind of reformed and regrouped and went on with it and got heavier and better as the years went on.
But he also, when he went away to college, it wasn't that far away, and we still practiced every weekend. But his influences were changing. He was listening at the time that new wave stuff was coming out, which, you know, and I'm not gonna insult Greg by saying he was, you know, listening to new wave music, because he wasn't. But I mean, there was a bunch of bands that were coming out, like bands from England, rap or stuff like that. They were kind
of, I mean, if you listen to a lot of even the stuff on Frost and Fire, some of the stuff, like, got a lot of weird, like, synth keyboards and, like, quirky stuff. It kind of reminds me of something like the Cars or something, you know. I didn't want to be the Cars.
So the thing was, I think he also wanted to move to Los Angeles, and I'll tell you, one of the reasons we never made it big was because we didn't live in Los Angeles. We're, like, around an hour up the coast, and I like to try to tell people, like, we're the first civilized outpost. The last civilized outpost before you get to Los Angeles, because I don't know if you've been, Los Angeles is like a giant city that spans like maybe like 1,000 square miles. It's like, you can drive for like days without seeing a tree, you know, and it's like a lot of parts are, I mean, there's a lot of rich people and a lot of nice areas, but it's also so large and so congested and confusing and back then really polluted and stuff. It was kind of creepy. We live right on the ocean. We're like around an hour north of there. You know, it's trees, there's hills, you know, it's not that many people living here, fresh air, you know, fresh air.
Yeah, and, you know, plus a lot of the thing, too, as far as, like, you know, struggling and getting their record labels and playing and stuff, I mean, there's like a lot of people, you know, competing for the same slot at all the clubs down there, and actually at a time, the clubs all down there, like the Whiskey, the Troubadour, the Starwood, all these clubs, they would charge you to play. They would make you pay in advance for your slot to play, and then they would make you sell tickets, and then if you didn't make your money back, that was just tough shit. So, I mean, that was kind of a turnoff for a lot of bands, too. I mean, I think they've changed their policy now because they figure, well, you know, they're going to make money anyway off drinks or whatever, but, I mean, it was just outrageous at the time. I mean, it's like, you know, all these bands fighting to, like, for the same little slots, and these guys are, like, you know, holding this cap over your head, you know, come down and we got to pay to play, and, like, you know, play on a Wednesday night at, like, you know, 2 in the morning, which are, and bring a busload of your people down there, you're not going to get paid. It's just really outrageous. So that's why, you know, we made it down there a lot of the times, you know, to play gigs and stuff, but, you know, we played a lot of stuff around here, and you know, that was, well, you know, kind of tough to do.
What Tim was saying, that was kind of coming in right near the end of our career, the pay-to-play thing was happening, but the way we got jobs is you just go down there and you'd hang out, and, you know, and I'd go down there, and you'd try to get backstage, and you'd try to talk to the booking agent, you know, and
give him a cassette or whatever,
and try to explain to him, you know, hey, man, you know, we're this big band, you know, we're playing all these shows and stuff, and will you let us play? And we got to play some pretty good shows. We played the Roxy, we played the Starwood, the famous place out of that movie Wonderland.
Well,
if you've seen with, what was that?
I don't know. The Whiskey Go-Go. All those clubs in L.A. So,
yeah, but getting in there, I'm not kidding, you know, you almost... get in there, you know, it wasn't easy to play. I mean, it was, you'd spend 6 months, like, courting these guys, almost like you're going to marry them just to, like, get a gig, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, then we'd have to print up posters, and we'd have to tell everyone, and a lot of people would come to our shows. You know, a lot of people look at, like, the last video that's on the web of us playing here in our own hometown, but that was the last show we played. The band was breaking up. There's only a few people there, but most of the real shows we played in Los Angeles were in small clubs, and they were packed to the gills. So.
Okay. When you refer to new wave, are you referring as well to like English bands like Iron Maiden, Saxon, and the new wave of British heavy metal, or not? Or?
Yeah, there's a difference between in America. New wave was more like
Cars.
Like the skinny tie crap, like the Cars and the Blondie.
Evo,
that kind of crap. You're talking about the new wave of British heavy metal.
Yeah.
NWO, BHM, or whatever the hell they call it.
Yeah.
That kind of came in, like,
later.
Yeah, later on. Like, that was in the later 80s, I think, in the mid-80s or late 80s. Yeah, so that was that's not what we mean by when we say new wave, so.
Yeah, new, over here, like, disco came out, and we're like, you know, we actually, people said if you would have been in a different time, we would have been more successful, but, like, right as we were, like launching our band, like all this disco crap was happening, and that's where it gets back to the dancing. Then you zip forward from the disco stuff, it went straight into like the new wave stuff, which was kind of,
and then the glam shit.
Yeah, and then the glam stuff, you know, and it's like by the time the actual real metal got around, like our band was broken up, you know what I mean? So.
The first album was re-released, I believe, in 81 by Enigma Records, is that correct or not?
Yeah, Green World actually changed their name to Enigma.
Oh, okay. All right, so it's the same label then. Oh, okay.
He said, when Bob said before about the distribution thing with Green World, well, after a while, they got to the point where they were distributing a number of bands. They said, well, let's just turn ourselves into a kind of like pseudo record company. And that's when they changed over to Enigma. And they were like, you know, kind of not producing, but, you know, they were more like a kind of a semi-record company. They're still kind of the same thing, but they just had a different name so they could promote themselves as a record company.
And we were the first band they signed, and the second band they signed was Motley Crue. I got to clear up some stuff about this, too. Motley Crue actually came, they actually had some guy from Grass Valley. It's a city up in Northern California, and he spent around $300,000 or more promoting the band. And so when they got signed to Enigma, they're all like, wow, not only do we have a band here, we got a guy that's going to spend a bunch of money on them. But within a really short period of time, the big record company saw, well, hey, not only here's a band, someone's going to promote them and pay for that money. So they moved off to Elektra. And from what we understood, they actually never paid the guy back and ripped the guy off at their start. So, you know, all of those bands, I'll tell you, you can put every one of those bands in a hat, and I have little respect for any of those hair bands were like a joke. We played with Rat. We played with Lita Ford. We played with Striper. We played with all these creepy bands, and they were just disgusting. And not only that, they screwed us on the sound. We didn't. I'm reading a book right now by Martin Popoff on all these old heavy metal.
Oh, he's a great writer, isn't he, Martin?
What's that?
He's a great writer, is Martin.
Yeah, Martin, exactly. Well, I'm reading a book Greg gave me, Ye Olde Metal, about the 1968 to 1972, and in there is...
Yeah, I have that one.
Yeah, it's great. Captain Beyond, and matter of fact, he told me, I talked to him the other day, he's going to, when he puts out the 80 version of Ye Olde Metal, he's going to do put a Cirith Ungol section in there, but... Captain Beyond said, you know, we played at the Hollywood Bowl with Alice Cooper, and they screwed us on the sound and the light, and that was our life story. Every time we opened up for a band, they go, well, you know what, you can use half the mixing board, or we'll give you three lights, or something. You know, I mean, we're playing at a big giant, you know, like a big concert, you know, or even not a big concert, let's say you're playing at this big club in Los Angeles, you know, and you have half the sound and half the lights, and it just kind of, it's like taking...
It's the gamesmanship sucked, man, back in those days. It's probably the same now, but, you know, everybody just had to make sure that you look like shit so they could make themselves look a little bit better, you know, but that was just part of the game, and it didn't really bother us. We just crank it up and just blow their heads off, so...
Yeah, not a lot of good video exists of us, and the one on this show was actually okay, but, I mean, when our band was playing at its peak, and when we were on our game... any band we played with or any show we play, we just blow people away. And I'm not saying that, I'm not bragging or I'm not trying to be overly pump the band. But, you know, Tim out there, you hear his voice is like a razor blade. And, you know, we had we always had giant amps, and so we were just blasting, and I'd be beating my drums. I used to play drums so hard, I'd actually cut my hands, and I had blood all over my drum set for a while, so.
So this Green World, or Nigma, whatever you call themselves, you feel as though they didn't do anything for the band at all, and really to get a name out there and try to...
They didn't really have the resources to do it. Like you said, they were more or less just a distribution company. They had, like, a pipeline, to just distribute stuff, and they really had no idea what they were doing, to tell you the truth. And we would have been much better off, like Rob said before, we would have just waited, and signed with done the thing with Metal Blade. But, I mean, at the time, that wasn't really rolling yet or anything, so we just kind of did what we had to do at the time to get our record out there. And, I don't even know I'm sure that company doesn't exist anymore, so, I mean, that just tells you, what kind of a good business model they had.
Well, here's what happened. Enigma got sold to Capitol Records, and I forget, they had some glam band or someone, they had Rat and all these bands on there, so they got sold to Capitol Records. But then the guys reformed as Restless, and this goes back, this is the tragedy of our band. It's like an abused wife going back and getting beaten by her husband over and over again. when we had the material for Paradise Lost, we were going down to L.A., and once again, we're trying to go down and try to find someone to actually put the record out. So we have nowhere to go to except our abusive old husband, right? So we show up at the Restless Records, which was Enigma, which what got resold. So the guys reformed as Restless, and they decided to put out a record. Now, the reason Flint quit the band and it took so long to do that, we had all these other members in the band, was Restless was going through this giant lawsuit with Capitol, and there's all this crap going on. And so it basically took us 3 years to get all that crap settled before they were ready to actually let us go into the studio. And the studio that we recorded at, which was right across the alley from our band room, they were putting in like a new mix console and doing some stuff, so that took 6 months to a year. So by that time, like I said, if when we were ready to do Paradise Lost, Gary would have been in the band, and Flint would still have been in the band, but by the time... Flint left, and Jerry left, and Jimmy was in the band. That's how that thing came around. But once again, we were still stuck on the same company. They really didn't want to spend any money on us. All they wanted to do was...
to have us handle a finished product, and then just more or less just distribute to whoever, wanted it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were not really a record company promoting or anything like that at all.
But let me tell you, I remember this, and Tim remember this too. This is what they said. They go like this, it's like, instead of producing one or two records and hoping they make it, we'll try to put out 100 records and like throw them against the wall and see which one sticks or something.
Yeah, and then that's who they'd throw some money at. So, it was kind of a bad deal, but that's just the way things were back then.
I remember though, Brian, I gotta tell you this, when King of the Dead came out, I remember showing it to Brian. Brian had actually started his label then. He had some bands, and it was kind of primitive, but he was still getting his first start. And he looked at me, and he goes, this should have been on my label. And I'm thinking probably, yeah. But, at the time, we didn't do that to cut him out or anything. What we were trying to do, we were just focused on trying to get up to the big time. I got to tell you this. If you read the Martin Popoff books on these bands, a lot of these bands that we worship, like Trapeze or Captain Beyond, any of these early heavy bands, Lord Baltimore, Dust, whatever, their stories are so much more depressing and sad than the story of our band.
Yeah, I've read them.
That makes me feel good. I talked to Greg last. Greg gave me this book for Christmas, and I go, thank you for giving me this book, because I feel, seriously suicidally depressed over our whole band. And after reading the stories about these,
feel so bad.
these are bands that I worshipped, and I'm thinking, hey, these guys, I seen Captain Beyond open for Black Sabbath at the Hollywood Bowl. These guys are like God. And then I'm reading in the book, it's like they're so broke that they had to take turns eating meals like one a day or something like that. So.
You said, Robert, that King of the Dead was the best album by the band. What do you feel that way?
Well, I'm going to let Tim handle this one. He was a big part of that. But.
That's the general consensus for most people and most, all our fans and stuff. But, it's got a lot of good stuff on it. Yeah, I mean, like all the albums, I like them all. And and they all have some great stuff on. I mean, really anything with Jerry Vogel's in them, you know, it's great. So, and Jimmy too. And yeah, that's most people. That's the consensus that it's our best album, and there's some really good stuff on there. You know, you can't deny how great, you know, like Match of the Pit, King of the Dead, Finger of Scorn, and that kind of stuff. So, and that was really, you know, when we just like after Frost and Fire, like Rob said, I mean, you know, we were like a new kind of like energy in the band and stuff with Flint and everything, and we decided, you know, we wanted to do what we wanted to do, get really heavy and epic, and I think that came across on King of the Dead, and that's why people, like, you know, still love it to this day.
And this is why, you know, and you probably read some of my things even on Amazon or whatever. I go in and write reviews and stuff, you know, small ones, but I kind of try to make it really truthful. And in King of the Dead, here's what I like about it. My parents actually loaned us some money for it, which we paid them back. And once again, you know, my poor mom's really sick. You know, she may not make it much longer, and my dad's gone. But, you know, they paid for that album, or we couldn't have done it. So, but we paid for it. We produced it. We mixed it. And I don't know if you heard the stories about Paradise Lost. In Paradise Lost, each member wasn't even allowed to be in the recording studio while the other guys were recording. On King of the Dead, every night we'd go down there, all of us, and we'd listen to the tapes, and we'd do guitar overdubs, or Tim would sing. Now, Tim would sing something, and I'd go, oh, man, yeah, that's great, you know. Or, like, Jerry play a guitar riff, and he'd go, oh, that don't sound that good, and so he'd redo it, and he'd go, oh, that's really great, you know. And so it was the first album and the last album that we had 100% control over, because we paid for it, we recorded it, we mixed it. No, we actually, there was no one
telling us what to do, and giving us, you know, speaking with stuff, so.
And getting back to Jerry, Jerry's passed away now, but I tell everyone this, and this is what I want people to do, is if you do listen to that album, listen to the double lead guitar solo on Spirit Thungle, the title, not the title, but the song named after the band. And I think that, to me, is Jerry's finest hour, where he's playing these two leads, and they're intertwined, and there's so much emotion.
He does all that stuff on there, because Finger of Scorn and stuff is...
Yeah, but he had so much... And once again, that's why I liked Mountain, bands like that, is like Leslie West had... He played the guitar. It wasn't how fast he played the guitar, it's how much feeling you put into every note. And guys like Jerry, and I know Leslie West was one of his heroes, but... If you listen to those kind of guitars, it's like the guitar, it's almost like it's singing like a person. It's not, once again, it's not how fast you play, or maybe even how perfect, but it's how much emotion that travels from the musician into the music. So that's what I look for.
I think that's what people get out of King of the Dead, too. They can feel all that, you know, passion and then everything that we put into it. So I think that's why it's a lot of people's favorite.
How would you say, how would you musically compare the second one to the first one, and how does it differ? Would you say?
Frost and Fire and King of the Dead?
Yeah, would you say King of the Dead, like, differs, like, what sort of direction was it going in?
Totally, like I said before, I mean, Frost and Fire was never really supposed to be an album, so it was like a conglomeration of things that we were doing at the time we thought would be more of a commercial effort to get a record deal. And like Rob just said right there, I mean, King of the Dead was a group effort that we really felt passionate about and wanted to show people what, you know, screw all this, like, commercial crap. Let's do the heaviest thing that we can do and the best thing that, you know, that's ever been done, and that's King of the Dead.
Okay. I believe I was it licensed to Roadrunner in Europe, that record or not, or?
You talk about Roadrunner?
That second album, was it licensed to them in Europe?
But, and I have kind of like a disappointing story about Roadrunner, because when Paradise Lost came out, you know, Restless was doing nothing for the band, and we actually signed a 3-record deal with them, supposedly, and they go, well, you know, if you guys are going to do anything, you got to get this out in Europe. And I said, well, look, you guys are the record company, you guys should be, like, getting it released or licensed in Europe. And they said, well, you know what, we can't find anyone to do it. So I actually called up the guy at Roadrunner Records, and I guess they listened to it, and they said, you know, it's just the same old crap or something, and we're not interested in it. And as soon as Roadrunner wouldn't release it in Europe, within a matter of weeks, we got a letter from Restless saying that they were dropping us from the label, or we had a contract that had, like, a backup clause or something in, so they were going to drop kind of sad, but you know what? I think all of our influences were from Europe, pretty much. You know, I mean, there's some American bands, but like, you know, we grew up pretty heavy on European bands, Uri Heep, you know, and the Savoy Brown, bands like that. So, you know, a Cream, you know. So a lot of our influences are from there, so I think it's no secret that we were actually playing for the European crowd, because, you know, we didn't see bands in America that would listen to our music. We thought the same people that listened to our music were in Europe, you know, and that's my biggest regret. Our dream was to go play in Europe, and we never really made it, and yet that's where I think if we would have gone over there, I think that...
People still ask us today to go over there. I mean, you know, like Rob was saying, I mean, a lot of our favorite bands were all European bands, you know, Scorpions, Lucifer's Friend, all this kind of stuff. I mean, that's what we listened to, and that's what we really wanted to be like, and we knew that was, you know, that was the European thing, and we really regret not being able to ever go over there.
Yeah, since we were the only guys over here listening to that, I mean, not the only guys, but I mean, like, you're saying all of Los Angeles, we go down to Los Angeles, and we have friends at these record stores, and they go, yeah, Lucifer's Friend, here's one copy, it's a European import, right? You know,
yeah,
so we buy it, so it's not like all these metalheads that lived in L.A. were there. There was just a handful of people that was actually listening to that. And I'm not judging the music by that, because all this music we're talking about is epic. But, I mean, it's still, the American public is not really the most faithful group of people.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking for all of us. I'm just speaking for, you know,
yeah, right,
the majority of...
What are your thoughts on the third record, looking back, One Foot in Hell?
Great. I like it. It's kind of a bit of a difference from King of the Dead. I think it just kind of, we matured a little bit by then and kind of had it down a little bit. I mean, it's a little bit heavier and faster, I think. And I really don't know why. I mean, it's just the way we felt like playing at that time. By that time, you know, Flynn had been in the band for a while, and we were all really involved in doing the songwriting together. And I think it's just, you know, it's got some really good stuff on it, some like really crazy guitar stuff from Jerry. I mean, stuff like War Eternal, stuff like a, you know, 10-minute freaking double guitar solo thing. And during the recording process, it must have taken like weeks to do some of this stuff, because, I mean, he'd be in there just doing leads and leads and leads, and we'd just be going, yeah, 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 do more. And, you know, it would just take forever to do some of that stuff, but I mean, I think it's a great record, too, and I actually listen to it all the time. Some of my favorite stuff is on there, like me and Rob wrote Doom Planet together, you know, and that's, like, one of my favorite songs, especially, like, some of the, you know, the vocal work on it, like Rob doing the crazy background stuff with me. And it's got some really good stuff on there. I mean, you know, we used to start off like concerts with, you know, with Blood and Iron and stuff. So it's one of my favorites, obviously.
Yeah, we wrote Doom Planet. You know, so when the planet is over, I want people. We want credit for that.
Yeah, we're going to play that at the end. When is the Mayan calendar on? We're going to play Doom Planet at the end of it.
You know, actually, that's the first album we signed with Brian on that one. And hopefully, you know, God, I wish we had. I'm not really sure what happened, but. You know, for some reason, we did that on Metal Blade, and I don't know why we didn't go back to Metal Blade after that. You know, I'm not sure whether they didn't want us or whether we didn't sell enough records or, I agree. I like it. I don't think it sounds, I think the music's as good as King of the Dead, but I don't think it sounds as good, and I think some of that could be attributed to when we recorded King of the Dead, we had, like, all the time we needed, and we actually went down to Los Angeles to, like, a bigger recording studio. And this gets back to Martin Popoff's book on these bands. I'm reading some of the things like MC5 or whatever, and they go, hey, you know, if you record the album, if you don't like it, we'll do it over. And then they record it, and they go, you know, we don't like it. And they go, well, you know, it's a wrap.
Too bad.
Yeah, they go, it's over. So, I mean, we went down there, we threw down some basic facts, and, you know, once you do that, you can't really go back and change them. So, but, you know, once again, I hate to keep going back to this poor book on, but Tim hasn't read it yet on Captain Beyond. They had an engineer that never been an engineer before on their first album, and they recorded the whole album out of phase, and so they had to spend thousands of dollars trying to get it to sound good. And we didn't have any of those really, really bad problems, but, you know, once you record a basic track, you can't go back and change anything to it. But I do agree with Tim. There's some of the best guitar works on there. And
there's some great songs on that album too, yeah. And they, especially the, I think it might, the artwork on the album is like obviously great too. I mean, all those covers by Michael Whelan are just fantastic. And, you know, I'm sure people, a lot of our fans probably, you know, had no idea who we were, and they'd be thumbing through, you know, like all the record bins and stuff, they'd come across something like that, giant fly god sitting on a throne with a guy threatening him with a glowing, like, sword. It's like, Jesus, I gotta see what's inside of this, man, so.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that's some great stuff on King of the Dead. It's awesome.
You mentioned the mix on the third album. Has it ever been talked about to remix it or at all, or anything like that?
No, I don't know, but Brian owns, you know, that's, they have the original tapes for that. I have all the original tapes for the first two records, but Brian has that. I don't know, you know, that'd be something they'd have to do. I do know this, we had some experimental, like, background vocals that didn't make it on there that were pretty
wild.
Yeah, pretty wild, that I didn't want to see him disappear, but, you know, once again, that was, Brian actually did the final mix on that, so. But I'm not really unhappy with it, and I think every album has its own tone to it. I just think when it goes back to, I always say King of the Dead, I like it the best. I'm not picking on our other records, I'm just saying, you know, it's like it stands out to me as the one that I feel proudest of, and maybe that's because I feel like all of us as a group had the most to do with it. Because, you know, once again, once we signed with Brian on Metal Blade, once again, you know, you bring Brian in a record company, you have all sorts of other people. And it's just, there's more cooks working on the recipe, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't make, you know, the end result good. It just means it takes less of the actual personal personality of the band out of it, and it colors it with different influence.
Rob, I believe you were, earlier you mentioned how Paradise Lost was recorded. Could you tell me about how it was recorded?
That was horrible. We had a producer, and I don't want to, you can look on the record and find his name, I don't want to really say bad stuff about people, but, you know, we're going through some, we're actually, it took so long to do that, we lost some members, and it was horrible and stuff, but, that's why, once again, on Servants of Chaos, there's some original, there's a copy of Fire, and a copy of Fallen Idols that we did in our regular studio as a demo. Once again, to try to get big record companies interested in Paradise Lost. And if you listen to those, I think the whole album would have sounded more like that than it did the way it came out. I was taken into the studio with a click machine, and I played all the drums back to no music, just me humming the songs in my head to a metronome. And to me, that's like, I don't know.
Yeah, there's no way to like make a metal album, but
yeah, it's like taking Van Gogh and giving him a ruler and putting a you know, a scarf over his head so he can't see. You know, his lines are all going to be straight, but that's not the point. The point was with this producer is like your drum beats got to get perfect. They have to be perfect aligned with the computer-generated sound machine. And to me, that takes away. So anyway, that ruined the whole album for me. The guitar parts none of us listened to. Him singing, none of us heard. I actually cried when I heard the album the first time. You know, it wasn't bad, you know, I kind of think we felt upbeat because at least we had another record out. I looked back on it, and it was, and what destroyed that album was the way we recorded it. And once again, we had a producer tell us how to do it. I mentioned this in another interview. Every time I complained, said, you know what, this is bullshit, I'm not going to do this. And then the guy said, well, we could just cancel the whole deal right now. And so that was...
That
was the alternative. Either do it their way, or you aren't going to do it. So...
Okay. Why did Flint...
The best part on all of that is probably Jimmy's guitar playing. Jimmy did some unbelievable guitar stuff on there. And
yeah, it's really a tragedy that Jerry, you know, I mean, that things didn't work out. I mean, our original plan was to have Jimmy and Jerry in the band, you know, together. And it's really too bad that never really worked out because that would have been freaking awesome, man.
Why did... Flint and Jerry leave, or what happened with their departures?
Well, Flint left, he was kind of getting disillusioned with, you know, with the whole thing. I mean, like Rob says, I mean, it's always such a struggle to get things done, to get records out, and it just, you know, it just took so long to do it, and as far as, like, jamming and stuff, and he just kind of got frustrated with the whole thing, I think, and he kind of wanted to, he stuff. He kind of wanted to play, you know, a little bit more like that kind of style stuff. So, you know, he kind of went his own way for a while, and was, I think he was in another band for a while, but he never really did any recording or nothing. So it was just kind of a disillusionment thing with Flynn, I think, and he was just frustrated with the way things were not happening and stuff. So, but as far as Jerry goes, I mean, like I said, our plan was to have, you know, all of us together and have Jimmy in guitar too. And at the time, Jerry was, you know, battling, you know, with alcohol and stuff, and that's really, that's what killed him eventually. But I think he kind of saw when we started bringing Jimmy around, he didn't really get what we wanted to do. I mean, me and Rob, you know, were, you know, would say, you know, this is going to be awesome. I mean, it'll free him up, you know, not to have to do the rhythm and the leads all the time. So he could just do his thing, which would be, you know, let him just shred and do his thing. And he kind of, you know, I don't know if he kind of saw it as a threat to his, you know, him or whatever, but it never really worked out that he was, you know, wanted to do it anymore. And he just kind of decided to, like, you know, not be involved in that situation. And it wasn't that long after that, I think, that, you know, he really got bad on the alcohol and it finally killed him. So I think that's probably what really influenced him. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's too bad that it worked out like that, and it really sucks that he's dead. But, I mean, at least he left a legacy of some really great stuff on those first three records. And it's too bad, like I said, that, you know, we never really got the band to go like that, because it would have been, you know, me, Rob, and Flint, and Jimmy and Jerry, man. I mean, there's nothing that we couldn't have done. It would have been awesome.
But yeah, but getting back to Martin, I keep going back to this Yo Metal book that I'm reading. A lot of these big bands that we worship, they lasted through one record, maybe like a year of touring or a couple of years, and then they were over. Or you know, at least some of the bands had these really short lifespans. By the time Flint left, we'd been in the band together for 10 or 15 years, and I can't remember exactly the date, but we had a band room, and we were paying rent, and we were all trying to work. We're all working full-time jobs. You know, we have girlfriends or family, you know, not families, none of us had kids at the time, but, you know, we'd get together every night, and two or three nights, or maybe four nights a week in practice.
We write songs, practice, you know, try to get gigs, try to make, you know, get record deals, try to do this and this, and it was just, you know.
But what about
the frustration, you know,
we're getting like hundreds of letters a day of fan mail, so we're writing them back and sending them stickers, and so we're paying for all the postage and stuff. So every month I'm hitting the guys up, you know, I need $100 for postage, or, you know, and at one time a year went by, Jerry didn't even pay his band rent, so I paid it for him. So, you know, I mean, asking money all the time of these guys, you know, hey, you know, and we had a nice band room, you know, we had red carpet, we had, like, lights, we had, like,
we custom built it, yeah.
We custom built this, it was kind of like, and it was right across, you could throw a rock to where the recording studio was, so, and we'd have people come over, and we'd have, like, parties there and stuff, we had, like, a little dressing room with a bar in it, so we had this really great place, but...
But after a while, it's just frustrating, I mean, when you're there, and you're practicing and doing all this kind of stuff, and you never... see anything happening to go anywhere. I mean, like, you know, we'd put out a record, we'd have, like, you know, high hopes, oh, this is going to be, you know, great and great, and then we'd sell some, and then it would just kind of, okay,
but
we'd never get any promotion from the record company or money. Yeah, and, you know, and then we'd struggle, and, you know, another couple of years, like, writing good material and practicing and trying to get gigs, and, you know, it was just, like, a whole cycle of stuff, and after, like, so many years, I mean, like Rob said, you know, Flint kind of got disillusioned with it, and I think Ted and Jerry did kind of in a way, too. And the last two guys standing at the when everybody else faded away, were me and Rob standing there in the band room going, like, well, I guess it's over, you know. So, I mean, that was, you know, that was kind of the end of the band. But, like I said, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that went on behind the scenes. And like Rob said, I mean, the band had been together for years and years, and it was just, you know, a lot of frustration and, you know, along with the good times and stuff, too. But, you know, after so long of, like, you know, just, your head against the wall, I mean, some people do tend to give up.
Well, here's a question I ask, and I don't want to get personal with you, but would you work 15 years at a job without a paycheck? I mean, we actually not only worked at this, and it was our, you know, our dream and our life, you know, goal to get this band going, but we never ever got any money for it. Matter of fact, every time we played a show, let's say we got paid $500 for the show, or maybe $300 back then. Okay, we had to go rent a smoke machine, we had to get a truck, we had to put out posters, you know, we had to call our friends up, we had to, you know, pay for gasoline, just bass guitar strings, and drumsticks. You add all that stuff together, after the show was over, after every concert that we played,
we were in the
red. Yeah, I go like this, can each one of you guys pitch in $100, you know? And so, and this is after you stayed up 20 24 hours, you know, we'd show up at 7 o'clock in the morning at the place we're supposed to play. We're supposed to be going on at 9 o'clock, the first opening act or the second act of the night.
Sound check, okay, and unload all your shit.
And then we unload all our shit, and then the time comes around for us to get a sound check, and the big band decides that, well, you're not going to get a sound check, and then you're not going to get a dressing room. And so you get home the next morning at like 3 or 4 in the morning, and every one of us, I can't speak for all of them, but I'm pretty sure, here's what I did. I got home at 3 or 4 in the morning, we put all the band equipment away, I'd go to bed for an hour or two, and then I'd get up and go work another 8 or 10 hours at a regular... You know, none of us are rocket scientists, so we'd be working real jobs, you know?
I probably would have got thrown in a towel way before then. Know me. You must definitely love the music, the pair of them.
Oh, yeah, that was all, that's what kept going for all that time. I mean, we really thought that we had something to give to people. I mean, when we were really into the music and stuff, and that's why, you know, we suffered through all that crap, you know? It was... Like I said, I mean, at least, you know, we have a legacy of, like, some really good stuff, and, you know, people can enjoy it forever, so, I mean, that kind of makes it worthwhile when you look back on it. You know, you can look back and look and think, you know, all this crap, the bad shit that happened and everything, you know, the frustration and everything, but then again, I mean, you know, you pop in, King of the Dead or something, you start listening to that opening, like, riff of King of the Dead, you know, the Sands of Egypt and Jerry doing his guitar shit, and you kind of go, well, hell, it was all worth it, you know.
What about getting Vernon Greene on board for the last album?
You know what? What happened was after all the other guys left, we got guys in, you know, we put up ads and guys would show up. So Vernon was a great guy. The other two guys in the band were great guys. The problem was, I mean, they were just short-term guys that came in, you know. And here's how I do it. Like,
it was kind of like me and Rob's last gas to kind of keep something going and stuff. I mean,
together.
It's
like a breaking up relationship. You could decide you're gonna have a kid. You know, to keep the relationship together.
Yeah, it was just. I don't know. It was just kind of an end game type thing, and it was never gonna really pan out. I don't think. And like I said, I mean, we were just kind of like grasping at straws at that time, to, you know, because Jerry left, Flint left. You know, I mean, Jimmy was great, like a great guitar player and stuff. But I mean, as far as the other.
But, you know, Jimmy quit, too.
Stuff goes, you know.
And like I said, every one of these guys quit. Jerry quit, Flint quit, Jimmy quit, you know, the Joe and the Bob guys, but they all quit. So when you walk away from something, you know, and almost every one of those guys, Vern's still in my hometown, and he goes, yeah, let's come over and jam and stuff. Well, you know, I say this to Flint, too. I go, you know, if you would have never left the band, maybe we would have made it. And it's too late to go back and say what things could have been like. But, you know, I don't know. What I'd like to focus on is, like, the original group in the first three albums, because that's kind of what I see our legacy as. Paradise Lost, I feel, even though it was really good material, and I don't dislike the record. I mean, I there's some really good parts on there. I still feel like I was run over by a truck doing it, and so it, when you get run over by a truck, you don't have that.
You don't go in like, you don't have strong feelings for that truck.
You mentioned Joe and Bob. I believe they are credited as like guest session musicians on the album or something.
Basically, what they did is they actually split before the record was even released.
Right.
So had Vern in the band, and so you know the thing was is like, you know, we brought them in saying, hey, you want to be on a record? We got a record deal signed. Matter of fact, that might have been another reason we got dropped from the record label. It's like, you know, our band was starting to disintegrate at the very end, and. You know, I don't know. I know both those guys were good musicians. They were competent. I guess this is a point where we can say, you know, the one song, Bar Eternal, was...
Did we ever play any songs? Well, I don't even know if we played... We might even have played, like, I think only, like... we might have played, like, just a couple of gigs, you know, and that's how long those guys lasted. So it was just, you know, kind of a weird thing.
I do remember, I have some funny stories about Joe, though. Joe was, like, kind of like a Ted Nugent-looking guy, and, you know, we always complain about show up in, like, ripped denim blue jeans or something, and his shirt...
He'd be rebuilding his, like, Dodge Charger out in the parking lot of where our studio was. He had the motor out and stuff trying to, like, do... He's, like kind of a crazy guy.
And what was funny, once for a show or something, we go like this, go, you know what, this ain't working, you gotta at least wear something, you know, we don't want you dressing up, but I go, you gotta wear something more than, like, a ripped t-shirt, right? And so, like, he showed up at the concert that night, and he had this whole, like, outfit on that actually looked really... It was really, I can't even remember what it was, but it was like this really
like
cool...
Like an angel would wear.
Was the Arthur Brown cover, like, the band's choice, or was it like a record label thing, or...?
Joe wrote The Troll, and Bob wrote what the song was, Heaven Help Us, or whatever it was.
No, the Arthur Brown cover, Fire. Was that, like...
That was the song, okay. Well, me and Jim kind of have roots going back to, like, the early days of psychedelia, like Cream and, you know, Jimi Hendrix and all that stuff. Arthur Brown's Fire was kind of like a pretty big hit here, you know.
Right, yeah, it used to be like a regular, like, on the radio in the 60s. It was a crazy world of Arthur Brown, you know, it's an old... I think it actually, I don't even know if he wrote it, like a song, it might even be older than him, and he did it, like made it famous, and we were kind of looking for, you know, a song to do, you know, a cover song to do, you know, just for the hell of it, and we always, you know, we've always seen it, like every album seems to have something with Fire on it, so we said, why don't we just do Fire, you know, so.
Yeah, and it, getting back to Servants of Chaos, the version on there is actually the version that we did the demo version, which was, I think, you know, nice points playing on that, that's the original guys in the band, you know, I think, Jimmy's on there as guitar, but it's fun playing the bass on there, and I think it's really good, man. That's my...
Yeah, I like that song.
What would you say is the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, then?
I would say it's the time. You know, Tim said, you know, we've been together so long, and, you know, when all the guys quit, me and I was actually crying. Jimmy's the last guy. Jimmy's all, I'm quitting the band, so he took his stuff. We're sitting in the band room. I'm looking. I had this brand new drum set that was given to me by Pearl Drums, and it's a kitchen, well, you know, it was a birch wood painted red. I had like 20 cymbals song. I had this unbelievable drum set. I'm just, oh my God, you know, I'm sitting here looking at it. You know, we don't have a band, and me and Tim were trying to decide, are we going to do this? We're going to get a bunch of more young kids in the band, like try to train them, you know, or like teach them our songs or get them to play our songs, or what are we going to do? And I think it was...
So yeah, and in the meantime, like Rob said, I mean, we had, like, overhead there. You know, we had a studio. We had, you know, we had to pay rent on that and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, but also had our house, you know...
Oh, yeah, but
yeah, we had
our family stuff.
Apartments, I mean, and...
Yeah, that's just kind of ended, like, you know... Not, it surely didn't end like we wanted it to, but, you know, that's just the way things are.
You may not have noticed that about every 10 years, the United States causes a worldwide recession for the rest of you guys. And so, you know, we went through two or three of those in the band, and... I can't remember when the band broke up exactly, like in 1991, but I'm not mistaken. I think we're going through another one of those periods where, you know, we're kind of broke. You know, there's not that much money around, and we're just looking at each other going, how much longer can we keep the shit on going without any kind of...
any kind of support from a record label or anybody else. I mean, it's just, you know, like I said, it's just always so frustrating, you know, like we put out those four records and, you know, I mean...
Plus, if the original guys would have stayed together, even Jimmy would have stayed in the band. If the core group would have been together...
Yeah, we might have kept going.
Yeah, we might have kept going. Like, let's say if Flint and Jerry never would have quit the band and Jerry never died, I could see us still together today, like, you know, Blue Cheer or something, because we'd have... It'd be like you're keeping your original marriage together, but like Newt Gingrich after you're on your third wife or something. Sometimes it's not that much...
What have you two been up to then since the band split up?
I can't speak for Tim, but I'm 5'10".
No, what have you been up to? Like, things, like, jobs and whatever.
Yeah, I used to be that tough. As far for me, I mean, I've just been, you know, working a normal job and, you know, I got a family and a house and kids and all that kind of stuff and putting them through school and everything, so that's kind of been my focus. You know, I get offers all the time. I mean, now, especially since, like, you know, we talked before about the, you know, the growth of, like, the social media and everything and the internet, and now that everybody's on Facebook and online and everything, I mean, I get stuff all the time from, like, you know, especially mostly the guys in Europe that do all the festivals. You know, oh, when are you guys going to get together? You know, we'll come over here and play, you know, get Sarah Dungle over here, and, you know, you can play at our you know, festival, and we'll pay your way, and we'll pay for your this and this and this. It's like, well, it's kind of hard to do when, you know... And Rob doesn't have a drum set. The only thing that I do is when I play Rock Band with my kids. And you know what I mean? So it's just, you know. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. Like, I just kind of lead a normal life, you know, bills and the house and the kids and, you know, just, yeah. And like I said, I get offers all the time and, you know, who knows what, you know, maybe, you know, someday I'll make it over to Europe and me and Rob will go over there and, like, come out of wheelchairs and introduce another band playing our stuff. There's actually tribute bands in Europe that I know of. In Greece and stuff like that are doing our stuff, so, you know, that's kind of a good thing for a tribute to us, I guess.
Yeah, there was that, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a tribute album that came out a couple of years ago.
1 Foot in Fire?
Yeah, One
Foot in Fire, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and every band on there, well, it's funny, when I first called Tim up and I said, you know, every one of these bands are playing our songs better than we did almost,
yeah,
you know.
Funny. the guy sent me the other day, there's a band actually called Finger of Scorn in Greece. That's a tribute band, and they're touring around Greece, and there's a few videos on the Serious Uncle Web Pit, which is online, and it's actually pretty good. I mean, you kind of go...
Are they playing their songs?
Yeah, they're a tribute band, dude. I mean, yeah, Mercy Rob doesn't even know about this yet. I watched them the other day, and there's like 3 songs up. And it's actually pretty good. You kind of go, man, I guess it kind of makes you go like, gee, I wish we were still together. These guys are like doing a pretty good job of our song. So, you know,
hey, maybe we'll get a free pass if they play somewhere local.
Yeah, really. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, we just kind of live a normal life and, you know, just kind of like I said, we kind of worked together here on the DVD thing. And then Rob and Greg did the whole Servants of Chaos a couple of years ago. And, you know, it's just nice that people still have, interest in our band. And, you know, we're actually putting out something new that nobody's ever seen before. Like I said, I mean, especially in Europe and stuff, and most United States or the world probably never saw us play. So putting out this DVD, which actually, you know, it looks pretty good. And like Rob said before, I mean, the sound is pretty good. So it's a decent representation of the band. Like right after King of the Dead came out, and, you know, it's Jerry kicking ass and Flint and Rob kicking ass. And it's, you know, it's actually really... a really good thing that we have this out, and we want to thank Brian for doing it, because, like Rob said, I mean, it would have been lost to history, and at least this way, people get an idea of, like, you know, well, shit, they never got to see us, but at least they can kind of see us now, in a way.
Yeah, I got to throw a caveat in there, you know, that whole thing, I mean, originally, you know, we paid the guy $20 to record it, I got the CD, not the CD, the cassette we gave the guy that did our sound, we always used to get a cassette, so we could listen to it later, almost like a football game to see, you know, if
see how bad we screwed up.
Or, you know, things you could improve or what have you. And that was the other joke on this, and this is kind of like a little secret. It's not so much a secret anymore, but cassette tapes were 45 minutes long. Our set was 45 minutes long. So when I'm listening to this cassette, and I was all excited when we first found it, I sit there listening to the whole thing. Right on the last, like, 10, 15 seconds of the end of the show, the tape runs out. It's a Maxell tape with a little cleaner thing on either end, right? But then the video keeps going on for another 10 or 15 seconds. So the guy that actually put this together, a guy here in our town, Frank Boris, who's like a kind of like a video
guru guy,
he actually found on one of our other live songs us doing another similar ending, and he kind of glued it on there. So it's kind of funny, the last 10 seconds. In fact, Tim's yelling out stuff like, no, we'll see you next time. You know, he doesn't have a microphone in his hand or anything, but...
The DVD looks really good and it sounds good, so it's a good representation of that time as a band, and I hope everybody likes it. So, have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't seen it yet, no.
Then you both go get it!
yeah, definitely. So, what do you two do for jobs, then?
You know, I gotta tell you this, what we do is not very impressive, and I'll tell you, I kind of work in the graphics industry, and I'm still working the same job. I was working a job, and it was helping paying the band's bills. When the band first had a record out, and I'm still doing the same thing, but I'm working in the basement, and I'm doing graphic artwork and stuff, and it's not...
Nothing glamorous.
Yeah, none of us.
We're not doing anything glamorous or musically, like, related.
Yeah.
I work in the manufacturing industry, and, you know, so...
Tim, at least, Tim goes to see concerts. The last concert I've seen was probably the one we played at. I mean, I get...
Oh, yeah, I have a son that's 21 years old, and, you know... I've been taking him to, like, concerts since, you know, he was, like, 15 and 16, which is kind of cool, because, like, you know, hey, there's a band called Megadeth, let's go see them, you know, or, like, crap like that. You know, I take him to go see all the good shows. I mean, you know, Sabbath and all the, you know, every band that comes around, you know, I go and take him, and, you know, it's really good to, like, you know, have somebody to turn this stuff on to. And, you know, him and his, like, friends like all the metal stuff, too, and, like, you know, he turns all his friends on to our stuff, so it's kind of cool.
Did you two stop, play music all together then after the band split?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it several times today, but like after Jimmy left, we're sitting there in the band room, and I sold my drum set for $1,500. You know, to replace it today would probably cost $20,000. And we had like this really bitchin' Con Strobe guitar tuner. I carried it across the street to the recording studio, and what's really funny, I seen the guy, he's still using to this day, they're using this, like,
oscillator.
You know, it's not one of those little cheap ones, you plug your guitar and a little green light comes on, it actually could tune pianos to it and stuff, and they're using it to this day, and we just moved out of the band room, and I sold my drum set, and I swore I'd never touch another drumstick as long as there was dirt bags in the music industry.
never going to change.
Yeah, and that's, I tell people I've kind of painted myself into a corner on that one. But I want you to know, if Kim was willing to sing and we could do it, I would play. But just the logistics of this, and you got to think about this. We don't have any equipment. We have no place to practice. We're all working full-time jobs. So you actually get us together to go put on a show somewhere, and then what if we didn't play as well as we wanted to? I think Kim's thinking along the same lines as me. I think that we're thinking that, you know, what we did at a time in our lives when we were younger, and we did it really good, and we're really proud of it. But, I mean, trying to go back and recreate that as much as we want to, I don't think that... I don't think it would make anyone happy, and I think we'd be afraid of disappointing the people that we want to not disappoint the most. So that's why that kind of answers the question. Everyone asks us over and over, why are we not, you know, reforming, or why are we not going to play? And we've had offers, but still, to get together and to practice and do all this stuff like we said, it just, to me, seems like it would be insurmountable to get all those logistics together.
I was wondering whether Jerry's death was another factor in why the band hasn't reformed.
Not really, but
okay.
He was not playing, you know, long before the band broke up. You know, after he quit the band, he stopped playing and he passed away, and we still were together. So, yeah, that wasn't so much. It just, I think, like I said, if the original group was willing, ready to play and wanted to do it, I think, and, you know, since Tim is, you know, Tim is, you know, still the singer, and it's his decision also too. I think that we. But you know what? I think Tim has to take off, and I might have to pretty soon. So.
Okay. I
another just, couple of quick questions and.
Yeah. Okay. I only got two more questions anyway.
But I also want to thank you for taking the time to do this. You know, I think we're both, and not just us. I think. You know, I can speak for all the other past and present members of the band, and, you know, except for Jerry, who's not alive, but I think all of us are, like, very humbled by this experience, and people still listen to our music to this day.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, even the Paradise Lost was, what, 91? That's, like, what, 20 years ago? I mean, 20 years ago, I mean, King of the Dead was 30 years ago or something. I mean, it's just amazing to us that, you know, like I said, we just put out like a, you know, a reissue of this with like new stuff and stuff. So it's, you know, it's really kind of humbling to like think, wow. I mean, you know, people are still interested in this stuff, and you know, we must have struck a chord with somebody. We must have been doing something right. I just, you know, I just wish we would have been doing it a little bit more successfully.
Yeah, I think me and Tim were hoping that they'll put one of our songs on a TV commercial, so we won't have to work those 12-hour days anymore.
Are there any other, like, reissues or compilations or anything like that in the pipeline?
Well, what I'm kind of hoping is that this reissue of Service of Chaos, you know, with the DVD, I mean, I don't know if you've actually seen it yet at all, but the packaging is, like, just incredibly awesome. I mean, the CD is like a triple-pack CD. It's got the double album, and it's got the DVD in. And they actually put out the double album vinyl, pulled out, you know, gatefold vinyls in Europe and stuff, and it just, I mean, it looks freaking fantastic, and I'm really hoping that, you know, I mean, that, you know, if we can sell enough of these, and I know they're actually doing some promotion from Metal Blade and stuff, because they, you know, they send us links all the time to the stuff that they're doing to get it out there, and, you know, guys like you and stuff that are helping, and, you know, I mean, what I'm really hoping is that, you know, since we did this, that maybe, you know, we can convince Brian, like Rob said before, we do have a couple other, like, videos that are actually different shows. We have one that actually have, like, Greg and Jerry together playing guitar with Flint and Rob and me. And I'm hoping that maybe, you know, we can go back and maybe release, you know, some of the other records as a box set with another DVD in them. But, I mean, well, time will tell if that's going to happen or not. But, I mean, that's really what I hope will happen, is if we can, you know, do a little bit of business with this and, you know, get people interested in something else. And hopefully we can go back and re-release those and put out another DVD, you know, and see what happens from there.
Okay, and my last question, what do you both feel is the legacy of the band then?
Well, I just think the legacy is like I said, I mean, it's just amazing to me that people are still interested and still want to do interviews, and, you know, we're still doing reissues of stuff that we did, you know, all those years ago. So I guess it holds up well for awesome music. And that's really, I guess that's why it holds up, because, I mean, we did it from, you know, we had a passion to do it, we did what we did from the heart, and we weren't trying to, you know, be posers or fake or kind of just put shit out there and just think people would buy it because it was, you know, commercial or whatever. We did what we wanted to do, and obviously, you know, a lot of people must have liked it, because then, you know, over the years, you know, we've heard all reports about, you know, all these bands that we supposedly influenced, you know, fans credit us, you know, for, you know, this and this and this and that, you know, and it's really, I think that's really our legacy as a band, is, you know, putting out great albums, and actually, you know, hearing from people saying, well, you know, you guys are a big influence on us. I mean, it's really weird, like you said, you know, we never really sold that many records, and I didn't really, you know, we weren't really ever that famous, but I guess a core group of people that were into us, I mean, they took it, you know, took some of what we had to offer, and, you know, took it to whatever heights that they could take it to, and that's, I think that's what our legacy is.
Yeah, well, it's just like when me and Tim or Greg were down in L.A. picking up a copy of Lucifer's Friends or Night Sun or Sir Lord Baltimore, that one copy somewhere in England or Germany or Italy or France or Greece, you know, some guys, even right now, some 13-year-old kid, and he's like picking up a CD of Frost and Fire or something. I think there's discerning music listeners, and there's a lot of junk out there, and there's a lot of crappy music, but there's a lot of good stuff, too, and I hope that people, you know, want that in some of heavy metal encyclopedia, they said we're the worst heavy metal band ever or something, you know? And that's kind of hard.
We can't take pride in that, because that means we were, I think we were kind of iconoclast. I mean, we didn't do it to please anybody else. I mean, we just did what we thought was good, heavy, epic music, and, I mean,
we were trying to please ourselves.
We just did what we did, and we thought we were just trying to put out the best stuff that we could possibly do, and, I, you know, like I said, I hope that it's held up all these years, and, you know.
Yeah, my hope is that future generations, just like I said, I'll go put on one of those old Trapeze albums or Captain Beyond or Cactus or any of those bands and listen to it, and it sounds as fresh today as it did when I first heard it. And I'm hoping that a newer generation of heavy metal listeners, you know, pick up King of the Dead and listen to it and go, wow, this is pretty cool.
They'll pick up Servants of Chaos and say, oh, you know, well, this stuff sounds really good. I mean, maybe to check out, you know, the rest of their catalog and, like, go back and go, oh, man, you know, they'll find, you know, One Foot Hell or, you know, King of the Dead or something, and, you know, just see what happens. Like I said, I mean, I hope we can do something else in the future with Brian as far as reissuing stuff goes, but, you know, time will tell about that.
Get your email in, Rob, and, yeah, thanks for speaking to me, boys.
All right.
Okay.
You're welcome. See you later.
Have a nice day, boys.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.